From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
It's not personal, son. It's strictly business.
On this New Year's Day, our interview with Francis Ford Coppola. He's released a new, re-edited version of Godfather 3. We talked about making his first Godfather film.
You know, I was 29 when I started. I had two kids and one about to be born. I had absolutely no money. I had no power, and I was always just trying to bluff the studio to let me do it my way.
Coppola wanted Brando to play Vito Corleone, but the studio had reservations, so Brando had to do a screen test.
I remember he came and he took shoe polish and made his hair black, and he was mumbling the whole time. Mm. Then he said, oh, he's shot in the throat in the story, so he should talk like this. And right in front of my eyes, he transformed himself into this character.
Francis Ford Coppola, coming up on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Happy New Year. It seems most New Years, at least one cable channel shows the Godfather films. In a weird way, I've come to think of it as a holiday film. For the 30th anniversary of Godfather 3, Francis Ford Coppola has released a restored and re-edited version of the film. It has a new title, too, Mario Puzo's The Godfather Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone. Spoiler. It's available on video on demand. Today we listen back to my interview with Coppola. We spoke in 2016 after the publication of The Notebook he kept when he was making the first film in the Godfather trilogy. He told some terrific stories about how he cast it and directed it. The Notebook contains his thoughts about each scene, including the pitfalls he wanted to avoid. The Notebook also includes pages from the novel that the movie is based on, Mario Puzo's novel, The Godfather, with Coppola's notes in the margins. The movie starts with these words.
I believe in America. America's made my fortune.
That's the character Bonacera, who has come to the Godfather, Don Vito Corleone, to ask a favor. Bonacera's daughter was brutally beaten after she resisted two boys who had tried to take advantage of her. Bonacera says he went to the police like a good American. The boys were tried in court, but the judge gave them a suspended sentence, and they went free that very day. Now Bonacera wants revenge against those boys. The Godfather, played by Marlon Brando, offers this response.
We've known each other many years, but this is the first time you ever came to me for counsel or for help. I can't remember the last time that you invited me to your house for a cup of coffee. Even though my wife is godmother to your only child. But let's be frank, you never wanted my friendship. And you were afraid to be in my debt.
I didn't want to get into trouble.
I understand. You found paradise in America. You had a good trade, made a good living, police protected you, and there were courts of law. But you didn't need a friend like me. But now you come to me and you say, Don Corleone, give me justice. You don't ask with respect. You don't offer friendship. You don't even think to call me Godfather. Instead, you come into my house on the day my daughter's to be married and you ask me to do murder for money.
I ask you for justice.
That is not justice. Your daughter is still alive.
Let her suffer then. As she suffers. How much shall I pay you?
Bonacera, Bonacera, what have I ever done to make you treat me so disrespectfully? If you'd come to me in friendship, then the scum that wounded your daughter would be suffering this very day. And if by chance an honest man like yourself should make enemies, then he would become my enemies. And then they would fear you.
Be my friend? Godfather.
Good. Someday, and that day may never come, I'll call upon you to do a service for me. But until that day, accept this justice as a gift on my daughter's wedding day.
Grazie. Grazie.
Francis Ford Coppola, welcome to Fresh Air. It's such an interesting way to start the movie because we're starting the movie by looking at a man, tight close-up of his face. We don't yet know who he is. He's speaking. Then it pulls back, and then we see he's speaking to Brando, and then we hear Brando speak, you know, Don Corleone. So why did you make that the opening of the movie?
Well, actually, I was working on the screenplay in a little cottage, one-room cottage in Mill Valley, and I had begun the sequence with the wedding itself, you know, the looser shots of the people coming, the guests in the 40s and what have you. And I had maybe 15 pages when a friend of mine, a screenwriter named Bill Cannon, his name was, I remember, and he came and he visited me. And I said, well, you want to see the first 15 pages? And he looked at them. He says, you know, Francis, You did such a good opening on Patton. That was such a striking opening for the Patton movie. Couldn't you do something more like that, something more unusual that kind of got you into it? And I thought, well, there was, you know, some truth to that. So after he left, I had the idea to begin in this way with this very, very close shot of the supplicant undertaker, Buonasera, and then slowly reveal out of the darkness of this the Don's studio, as opposed to the brightly lit wedding scene, the various characters, you know, the Brando himself, his son, Sonny, and what have you. And I rewrote the opening and added it to the screenplay.
Are there ideas and images, stories from your own family that you put in that opening wedding scene?
Oh, absolutely. I knew nothing about five crime families, which had recently become exposed to the public with the publication of the Valachi papers. But neither did Mario Puzo, who was also Italian-American, but he knew nothing about it. And he wanted to write this book sort of to get some money for his family. He thought it could be commercial, and he did everything on research. He knew nothing. He never had met any of these figures, and he advised me never to meet them, which I never did.
What about after the movie? Did you meet any of them then?
You know, Mario Puzo was just a wonderful man, and I always took his advice to heart. And once when I was working on Godfather Part 3, which in my mind was the Death of Michael Corleone title, I was in this video truck, which had only one door. And there was a knock on the door, and the fellow who was, you know, sort of helping me and guarding me, as it were, came and he says, John Gotti is here and would like to come pay his respects. And, you know, I remember Mario Puzo saying, never, never know them, never meet them, never be a friend of theirs, because they're very charming. And I said, well, tell them I can't possibly do it. I'm busy in the middle of something. And the fellow went out and told him, and he just went away. You know, I always thought of these figures of the crime family sort of like the old myth of vampires, which a vampire can only come into your life if you invite him to step over your threshold. But if you don't invite him, then they won't.
I'm sure people who were in the mob would be very flattered to hear that comparison to vampires.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, they are Italians and Americans, but they were not human beings that acted beyond being like animals, in my opinion.
Did you worry, though, that the film was setting the wrong example because the characters became such heroes of popular culture and there were Italian-Americans who felt that, like, you were discrediting Italian-Americans?
Well, you know, in truth, I was worried about so many things during the making
yes.
of that movie.
You know,
I was like about 29 when I started. I had two kids and one about to be born. I had absolutely no money. I was making what had become a more important film than it was when I got the opportunity, because the book had continued to become more and more important, and I had no power, and yet I had real opinions on how it should be done, and I was always just trying to bluff the studio to let me, you know, do it my way, and it was just the most frightening and depressing experience I think I've ever had.
I'm sorry to hear it. Thank you so much for making the movie in spite of that. So you write that when you actually, you were invited to direct the movie by the studio, by Paramount.
Right.
And you sat down and read the book. And you write, I read it eagerly, but barely finished it. And you almost didn't make the movie because you didn't really like the book, in spite of the nice things you said about Mario Puzo. What didn't you like about the book?
Well, I had thought from its title and the intriguing logo and the name Mario Puzo that this was a kind of Italian intellectual writer, like a kind of, you know, Moravia or something, and it was going to be a piece about the subject of power. And while indeed it was about power, I found the book itself more like a kind of bestseller attempt, like an Irving Wallace book. People don't remember it, but maybe a third, if not more, of the book concerned this young woman, Lucy Mancini, and her private anatomy problems and a love affair with the doctor who fixed them. And I just couldn't believe how low class that was. But that was, you know, not included in the movie, and so it didn't harm the remaining part, which we all know.
Did you ever tell Mario Puzo your thoughts about the novel?
Sure, he knew, and you know, he had written a beautiful book called The Fortunate Pilgrim, which he felt was the best book he ever wrote, which also was about immigrants. But it was very respected by writers, and it was a beautiful book, but it didn't make money. And, you know, like so many Italian men, he adored his children. He wanted to give his children some, you know, better life. And he wrote this hoping it could make a lot of money for himself.
It did. Yeah.
And it did.
Yeah. The Mario Puzo novel, The Godfather, is set in the 70s. The movie, part one, is set, you know, starts out in the mid-1940s, just after World War II. Why did you want to change the time that it was set in?
I didn't change the time. That's the way the novel is. The novel starts out exactly. I was very loyal to the novel after I had derived what the movie would be, and it was set in the 40s. That was one of my first arguments with the producers was I felt it should be set in the 40s. They had wanted and really had a script.
Oh, they wanted it set in the 70s.
Yeah, because,
okay.
and you know why, of course. If you make a movie during the contemporary period that the movie's being made, you don't have to have special cars, you don't have to have special costumes, you don't have to spend all of that money trying to create a period.
I see, okay. So that was one of your first fights with the studio.
Very big fight because they had planned to use this script. I mean, the script had hippies in it because it was going to be set in the 70s. And the studio was just had this young director who was hired mainly because he was Italian-American, and they figured that would possibly be good in terms of saying, well, an Italian made the film. And also, I had some acclaim as a screenwriter, and they knew this script needed to be worked on, so they figured they'd get a free rewrite out of it, which they did. And also, I was young and had no power, so they figured they could just boss me around, which they proceeded to begin to do.
If you're just joining us, we're listening back to my 2016 interview with Francis Ford Coppola about the making of The Godfather. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my 2016 interview with Francis Ford Coppola about the publication of his book, The Godfather Notebook, a reproduction of the notebook he kept when he set out to make the film. So the book that was just published, The Godfather Notebook, is what you describe as your prompt book. And you say this is the kind of book that usually like stage managers used with like lighting cues and exits. You also have your notes to yourself. You have summaries of each scene, and you have what you call the core idea of each scene. This is an idea that you borrowed from Ilya Kazan. So I want to play a scene, and then I'm going to ask you what the core idea was. So this is a scene at the wedding early in the film, and Michael, played by Al Pacino, is explaining to his girlfriend Kay, played by Diane Keaton, that his father knows the famous singer Johnny Fontaine, who has just shown up at the wedding. And Kay says, like, gee, how does your father know him? And then Michael explains. And in explaining, he explains a little bit about the family business.
Well, when Johnny was first starting out, he was signed to this personal service contract from the big band leader. And as his career got better and better, he wanted to get out of it. Now, Johnny is my father's godson. And my father went to see this band leader. And he offered him $10,000 to let Johnny go. But the band leader said no. So the next day, my father went to see him, only this time with Luca Brasi. And within an hour, he signed a release for a certified check of $1,000.
Well, how did he do that?
My father made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
What was that?
Luca Brasi held a gun to his head, and my father assured him that either his brains or his signature would be on the contract. That's a true story.
ma pallarezza stunga morì.
That's my family, Kay. It's not me.
That's my family, Kay. It's not me. So what was the core idea of that scene?
Well, Michael's dressed in the uniform of a Marine, and Kay is clearly his non-Italian or WASP, as Mario would say, girlfriend. And the core of the scene, so it means he's serious about her. And the core of the scene is that Michael discloses that his family, as charming as they may appear, are really murderers.
So in your notebook, you write that clearly Johnny, the singer, is a movie star. And you write, should you cast the only star in the movie in that role? And though Brando was already a star, so.
But Brando wasn't cast at.
Oh, he wasn't cast yet. Okay. No. So were you thinking of casting Eddie Fisher? Did I read that right?
Yeah, for Johnny Fontana, I liked very much Eddie Fisher, although he was not Italian. But I also liked Vic Damone. I had several thoughts.
And what happened?
I don't remember what happened with Eddie Fisher, but Vic Damone politely declined. Vic Damone was known to, you know that Frank Sinatra was not so happy about the reference, and, you know, they were afraid.
Afraid of retribution from Sinatra or from people Sinatra was connected with?
All the above.
In each scene in your notebook, you have a list of pitfalls you might fall into, and perhaps the most common one that you're worried about is cliché. What were some of your biggest worries about turning the material into clichés?
Well, having been raised in the family of Italian-Americans, who all of them were accomplished musicians, they weren't gangsters, certainly, but so much of the detail of life, what the bottle of Anisette looked like, the fact that they would sometimes send out for Chinese food, I knew a lot of stuff through living with my father and my uncles and my family, that I used those details in the film. And my fear was that, you know, Italians were always a talker, like people like the Marx brother, Chico Marx. And there were so many cliches related to us as the culture of our family that I certainly, you know. And also I knew that the Italian American didn't speak with an Italian accent. One of my big arguments with the studio was saying, well, you know, he wouldn't speak with, he would speak more with a Brooklyn accent. It'd be more like Eddie Carbone in A View from the Bridge, you know. So I knew things just by having lived them, that I could avoid cliches.
You also wanted to avoid the dialogue sounding too guys and dollsy. So what were your fears there?
Well, just that, you know, Italian-Americans were always portrayed in the movies, even on stage, a certain way gangsters were. And I knew different because those were my family. My father was the first flute of the NBC Symphony, so he was you know, certainly a man of great culture and education. But you know, he also the food he ate and what it was like in our home was something I could borrow and invest in the film to give it authenticity.
If I'm not mistaken, it was your grandparents who were the immigrants in your family.
Yes, all four. My mother's family were from Naples, and my father's family was from what's called Lucania, or otherwise known as Basilicata.
Did you know them?
Yes, oh yeah.
I wasn't sure how long they lived.
No, yeah. The most charismatic character, whom all of the uncles, they were all boys. My father's father had seven boys. And those were of course, my uncles, and they all imitated my grandfather, including my father, all his little gestures and his little sardonic remarks and his the way he would hold a little Italian cigar. That was from this grandfather, who was unusual. But he died when I was about five. I remember him. He was ravaged by diabetes, but he always, you know, would feel, he was blind at that point, but he would feel the kids' faces and give us a Tootsie Roll they had in his pocket.
About the character Clemenza, who's like very heavy, he's not only a heavy, he's he weighs a lot. He's heavy. He's the one who's cooking the sauce in the movie. Right. And you write about him in your notes that he has to be believable as the type that would be everybody's favorite uncle, but also a killer. Right. Did you have an uncle who resembled him in any way?
I did. They were twins, and they were both a little heavy set, and they were the least accomplished of all the boys. My grandfather's sons were fine musicians and excellent engineers, and but the twins kind of were not. But they were the youngest, and to us kids, we loved them because we could always get them to take us to the movies. We could always fool them into driving us somewhere, and they weren't like Clemenza in that they were favorite uncles, but also killers. The funny thing, a note that is fun, is that when I wrote the scene of Clemenza cooking, I can cook. So when I wrote the scene of Clemenza describing how to make a tomato sauce with the trick of meat sauce is that you put a tablespoon of sugar, but I said in the dialogue, I said, well, first you brown some sausage and then you blah blah blah, and the note from Mario on the script said, Francis, gangsters don't brown, gangsters fry. So that's what Mario was. He was always like, correcting with notes on the page, and he was wonderful. It's true, you know, gangsters would never say brown.
We're listening back to my 2016 interview with Francis Ford Coppola about the making of The Godfather. We'll talk about casting Marlon Brando and Al Pacino and how Coppola had to fight with the studio to do it after a break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working together to create a just world where all people have access to renewable energy, clean air and water, and healthy food. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, working to harness the power of research to make a difference in the lives of children, teens, and young adults for more than 80 years. Learn more at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of my 2016 interview with Francis Ford Coppola about making his masterpiece, The Godfather. A reproduction of the notebook he wrote in preparation for making the movie, which he carried around and referred to throughout the shoot, had just been published. It's called The Godfather Notebook. It includes his notes to himself and his annotated pages from the Mario Puzo novel that the film is based on. So you write to yourself in the Godfather notebook, with the Godfather, there is always the possibility of immediate and sudden violence. That's certainly true. You had to decide how explicitly violent to make it. What was your conversation with yourself about how the violence should be handled?
Well, I confess that I was very impressed with Arthur Penn's Bonnie and Clyde, and
I thought about that when watching Sonny Corleone get shot.
Without a doubt, and I thought that the effects, the depiction of violence in Bonnie and Clyde always had an imaginative twist to it. That it's one thing to see someone shoot someone, but if there's a detail, the way the blood turns into mist, or the way, you know, something that you have And I saw that in Bonnie and Clyde, I thought was just absolutely wonderfully done. And I looked up who had done the special effects, and that wonderful man, A.D. Flowers, his name was, worked on The Godfather and on Apocalypse Now, and he was just the most, you know, in the film industry, you deal with a lot of people on the crew who are sort of geniuses in the rough, you know, the way they come up with ideas for special effects and what have you. And I've been blessed to have those people help me in making these films. Films are a tremendous collaboration, as you know. It's not a one-man show by any means.
Okay, well, perhaps the most, or at least one of the most memorable scenes implying violence in The Godfather is the horse's head scene. It's the scene.
That's a good example because it's not done in the movie the way it's done in the book.
Yes. Okay. So let's. Why don't you set up what happens? Like what happens in that scene?
Well, it's a famous movie producer who is proud of his stable of beautiful stallions and priceless. A horse could cost $500,000 or more in the '40s, and they've asked him to cooperate with their request to give the singer the role. And what happens famously is that the producer wakes up and he sees a shadow I'll describe it the way it is in the book. He sees a shadow and he opens his eyes and he looks and he sees the severed head of his beloved and prized stallion that has been decapitated. Well, when I had to direct that, I thought, well, gee, you know, maybe it would be interesting if at first the man, you know, to trick them, to make it think something else, that maybe he had been mortally wounded, that he wakes up and he feels something weird and he uncovers the sheet and there's some blood and maybe his leg has been shot off or he's been castrated or, you know, let the audience think something else has happened. And then as he panics and flings the bloody sheets away, it then reveals the severed head of the horse.
In your notebook, you keep a list of pitfalls, of things that you're afraid to fall into.
That I should avoid.
That you should avoid. So your pitfall to not fall into for this scene, you write, if the audience does not jump out of their seat on this one, you have failed. Too much in the Corman horror film tradition would be a mistake. And you had worked for Corman early on in your career.
You write,
one must find the perfect balance of horror without losing the thread of the overall film. Deliver it and get out. So you wanted a kind of horror element, but not to make it kind of like a cheap horror film?
Yeah, and also everyone knew. They had read the book. That was one of the famous scenes of the book. So how could I mislead them to think that maybe what they thought was going to happen wasn't going to happen for a second? And that's why I put the horse's head in the sheets so that he could think the blood was his own blood at first.
We're listening to my 2016 interview with Francis Ford Coppola about the making of his first Godfather film. Recently, Coppola restored and re-edited the third in his trilogy of Godfather films. It's now available on video on demand. We'll be right back after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and Asia, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, the federal agency that supports the arts and creativity in communities across the nation. More information is available at arts.gov.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my 2016 interview with Francis Ford Coppola. When I spoke to him, he had a new book which reproduced the notebook he wrote and referred to during the making of his first Godfather film. So casting Marlon Brando was just such a really brilliant stroke, and stroke of luck, as you were able to get him. And I want to play what Mario Puzo told me in 1996 when I interviewed him about casting Brando, about how Brando got cast in the movie. So can I play that for you? And then,
of course.
Okay. So this is Mario Puzo, who wrote the novel The Godfather, speaking with me in 1996 about casting Marlon Brando.
I'm the guy that picked Brando.
You did pick Brando.
Oh, sure. I wrote him a letter, and he called me up, and we had a chat, and then I tried to get Paramount to take him, and they refused. And then when the director came on the picture, I talked to the director, Francis Copeland. He managed to talk Paramount into letting Brando play the role. But it was my idea to cast Brando, which caused me a lot of trouble before it finally got done.
What did you say in your letter to Marlon Brando when you were inviting him to play the part?
I think it was something like, help, they're going to kill me. They're going to cast, I think it was Danny Thomas as the guy.
Danny Thomas? Wow.
Yeah. Well, he was going to buy Paramount so he could play the role. At that time, Paramount wasn't really worth that much. And Danny Thomas was very rich off television. And I read an item, he was going to buy Paramount Pictures so he could play The Godfather. So that scared me so much, I wrote a letter to Brando. I knew some people who knew him, so, you know, I had an entree. And he gave me very good advice. He said, no studio will hire me. Wait until you get a director, and then talk to the director. And he's quite right. When I talked to the studio, they swore they would never hire Brando.
Okay, Francis Ford Coppola, you were the director. I suppose Puzo talked to you, and you made it happen. Can you pick up the story from there?
Well, it's true that Mario had always liked the idea of Brando, but, you know, Mario was often Bayshore. He was not really on the scene so much, as even a lot of my work with him was my sending him drafts and him writing notes. So although he had posed the idea of The Godfather being Brando, I don't even know if he told me that, because I just was hit by a whole bunch of ideas from the studio. Danny Thomas was one, Ernest Borgnine. It was a whole bunch of ideas. Even Carlo Ponti was suggested. And finally, I came down to the thing about the character of that character was that, you know, you couldn't find anyone new, as we had done for all the other parts. Al Pacino was totally unknown. Johnny Cassell was, Bobby Duvall was relatively unknown. So a lot of new people got big parts. But like a man who was supposed to be in his 60s, it couldn't be new and like had never been in anything before, because what was he doing all those years? So finally, with my colleague in casting, Fred Roos, we said, well, who are the two greatest actors in the world? So we said, well, Laurence Olivier and Marlon Brando. Each one had a difficulty for that part. Olivier was British. He was perfect age. He looked like one of the real guys, Genovese. And Brando was only 47 years old. He was extremely handsome, as always. He had long, flowing blonde hair. And most important, he had just been in some pictures, notably one by the great Pontecorvo called Burn. That was a huge flop, tremendous financial flop. So the studio felt that Brando was supposedly difficult to work with, sort of irresponsible, you know, would cause big delays. The film was only budgeted for $2.5 million, you have to understand. It wasn't like we could throw money around. And my decision to make it in the 40s and have period cars and shoot in New York was already impacting the cost, so that's one of the reasons why I was so unpopular. But they also hated my casting ideas. They hated Al Pacino for the role of Michael, and they hated Marlon Brando for the role of the Godfather. And I was told categorically by the president of Paramount, says Francis, as the president of Paramount Pictures, I tell you here and now, Marlon Brando will never appear in this motion picture, and I forbid you to bring it up again.
But you won. How did you win?
Well, when he said, I forbid you to bring it up again, I like feigned that I just fell on the floor on the carpet and like, you know, as if, you know, what? And then I said, what am I supposed to do? If you tell me I can't even discuss it, how can I be a director if the part I think should be cast that you won't even let me talk about it? And I said, all right, we'll tell you it this way. One, if he will do the movie for free. Two, if he will put up, if he'll do a screen test. And three, if he'll put up $1 million bond that he will in no way have any misbehavior that causes the overrun of the picture budget, then you can do it. So I said, I accept. So at least they were saying if I did three things, have a screen test, if I could get him to do the movie for nothing, and if I could have him put up $1 million, which is absurd. But at least I said, I accept, meaning, okay, now I can talk about it.
So did he do the movie for free?
No. I called him up and I said to Marlon, you know, of course this is an Italian-American, you know, wouldn't it be fun if we could, like, do a little experiment and kind of improv and see what playing an Italian might be like? That was my way to talk to an actor, essentially asking for a screen test, but I didn't put it in those ways. And I knew that if I could do something with this little screen test that was convincing, the absurd idea of him doing it for nothing, although they didn't pay him much more than nothing. I think they paid him scale, which was an insult. And obviously the putting up a bond to prevent misbehavior was, you know. Sometimes, you know, you say you accept terms, meaning that you just have a way to continue. So the important thing was to do some sort of a little screen test that I could get on tape and show to all these executives.
So you played this kind of little trick, and he did improv on, or whatever, on film for you. What did he bring to that audition that he didn't realize was an audition?
Well, I'd always heard the rumor that Marlon Brando didn't like loud noises and he always wore things in his ears. So I took a couple of my colleagues from San Francisco from this period of, you know, having young filmmakers all have a come. And I told them all to dress in black and no one was to speak. We would do sign language. And so we descended on Marlon's house early in the morning. He wasn't up, and these dinges went to different corners and set up their cameras. And I also brought a whole bunch of, like, Italian sausage and little Italian cigars and provolone and little things, and I put them in dishes around just without even saying what I was doing. And then the door opened. They said he was going to wake up, and the door opened. Out came this beautiful man in a Japanese robe with flowing blonde hair. And we're shooting all of this. And he came out and he didn't talk very much. Marlon was a brilliant man, and he just knew what was going on instantly. And I remember he came and he took his hair and he rolled it up and made it sort of like a bun in the back. And then he took shoe polish and he made it. And he was mumbling the whole time. And he made the shoe polish and made his hair black. And then he put on the shirt that I had brought. And I remember him folding the lapel. He says, those guys always, their lapel is always folded, he said. And right in front of my eyes, then he said, oh, he's shot in the throat in the story. Somebody should talk like this, you know, his throat. And he started doing that. And right in front of my eyes, he transformed himself into this character, and I couldn't believe it. And then he started picking up the sausage and eating it, and he just gravitated to the props and was using it to create a kind of Italianness the way he did it. And the whole time he was just going like this. He was going, he wasn't saying anything, which was funny because his phone rang. This was his home. This phone rang, and he picked up the phone and went, I said, my God, who was it who called? What are they going to think? But when it was all done, I had this tape, and it was quite remarkable.
People were afraid in the studio that Brando would be hard to work with and he would create problems. Mm-hmm. Did any of
Absolutely.
That happen?
Yeah, not at all. He was a joy to work. You don't talk a lot to Marlon. You sort of just give him, like I would take a cat and put it in his hands, or I would have some Italian props, or you don't direct him by talking about acting. What he likes to hear is make it more angry, make it less angry, make it sweeter. You know, he doesn't want to have any acting kind of talk, but he knows obviously what he's doing. And I'd had the blessing of having the cast together for about 3 days. So all of the actors, we got together. We had the first thing we did was to have a dinner up in Patsy's restaurant, around a table with Marlon sitting, when they all met him for the first time, sitting as the father, and Al to his right and Jimmy to his left and Bobby Duvall. My sister Tally was serving the Italian food. And they just did an improv together as a family. And that, when that was over, they were a family.
Was it Brando's idea to stuff his cheeks so that he'd look really jowly?
Yes, he said he wanted to look like a bulldog.
So the studio didn't want you to cast Al Pacino in the role of Michael Corleone. So how did you win that one?
Well, the problem is that when I had known Al a little bit before, so when I read The Godfather book, as I had him pictured in my mind, I saw him walking through Sicily with the two shepherds with their shotguns, and I couldn't get that out of my mind. I couldn't see Ryan O'Neill, who is what Paramount's first choice was, and I couldn't see Bob Redford. And, of course, you know, it's true that Sicilians are often blonde and blue-eyed because of the French presence in Sicily for, you know, over 100 years. But I saw Al Pacino, and I just wouldn't give up on him. And I began to realize that Bob Evans, who was the chief executive, and you know, he was very tough on me. But I have to always say, when I speak of Evans, he's not without talent. He definitely is a man with talent. It's just that he's he wanted really a Michael that was better looking, taller guy like him. And I wanted Michael to be more like a Southern Italian, more like me.
If you're just joining us, we're listening to my 2016 interview with Francis Ford Coppola about the making of his masterpiece, The Godfather. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to my 2016 interview with Francis Ford Coppola. At the time, he had just published a book reproducing the notebook he wrote and referred to during the making of his first Godfather film. I want to ask you about the final scene of The Godfather, where Michael basically draws the line between what's business and what's family. Kay wants to know if it's true that Michael killed Carlo, his brother-in-law, his sister's husband. And Michael says, you know, I'm not going to talk to you about business. There's a line between family and business. But then he tells her, just this once, I'll tell you. And he lies to her and he says, no, I didn't kill him.
But that's been set up throughout the movie. If you even in the scene we discussed before, when he goes to ask her to marry her, he says, just this one time, I'll tell you something, but I won't. Or when he tells her the story about your brains or your signature on the contract, he always limits it that he's telling her these things because he loves her, but that there will be the end of that, that she shouldn't ask him anymore. So at the end, you know, that is the final lie, and he closes the door on her.
Exactly. I mean, literally. Like, he walks into another room where there's a business meeting about to take place in their home.
Well, it's the meeting of him becoming the Godfather. They're kissing his hand and just as the door is closed.
Right, and somebody else comes over, one of his men comes over and shuts the door on her. So the last shot we see is of his wife getting shut out. And right. It's a really interesting place to end the movie. I don't think that's how the novel ends.
No, the novel ends with a scene that indeed we did shoot, which is Kay going to church lighting candles for him. But
hoping to save his soul.
Yeah. you know, but because that thread of don't ask me about my fam, don't ask me about my business, don't ask me, don't, I'll tell you this, but I'm not going to tell you more. He finally says to her, all right, I will answer this just one time. I will answer it, but then I won't ever again. And then and she says, did you kill him? And he says, no, he lies to her. And then the door, and I just felt emotionally that when he, that door gets closed on her, just as the other, what they call capo regimes, are kissing his hand, that that was the ending. And to go to her lighting candles was anticlimactical. So I ended it there.
And we're kind of like her because she loved him and she believed in him. And we like him a lot at the beginning. I mean, in the sense that, like, he's not part of the killing. He's not connected to the business. He slowly becomes part of it. And we have to keep asking ourselves, who is he becoming throughout mm-hmm. the film, and how do we feel about him?
Well, I always, you know, when I make a movie, I always have to have a theme, preferably in one word, that I can give my, when I made The Conversation, the theme was privacy. When I made The Godfather, the theme was succession. And I taught my children to try to know what that big theme is, because a lot you have to answer so many questions every day about, should she have long hair or short hair? Should she wear a dress or a skirt? Should he have a car or should it be a bicycle? And you know the answer, so you just fire them off. But once in a while, you don't know the answer. And that's when you say, well, what is the theme? I remember in the conversation where we were picking sort of trench coats for the character that Gene Hackman, and I didn't know which one. I don't want him to look too much like a detective. He wasn't really a detective. And then I said to myself, well, what's the theme? And I said, privacy. So there was one coat that was a plastic coat that you could see through. So I chose that. So your theme, in the case of Godfather being succession, I would always know that as long as I was telling a story of the succession of, there was a king and he had three sons and one was very this and one was very that and blah, 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 I knew that what I was doing.
Francis Ford Coppola, thank you so much for talking with us about The Godfather. Thank you so much for making The Godfather and for insisting on the things that you wanted to make it as good as it is.
No, thank you so much and for your wonderful program, which I've enjoyed throughout many years.
Francis Ford Coppola recorded in 2016 after the publication of his book, which reproduced the notebook that he wrote and referred to during the making of his masterpiece, The Godfather.
Michael, is it true?
Don't ask me about my business, Kate.
Is it true?
Don't ask me about my business.
No!
All right. This one time I'll let you ask me about my affairs.
Is it true?
No.
I guess we both need a drink, huh?
Francis Ford Coppola has just restored and re-edited the third film in his Godfather trilogy. It has a new title, too. Mario Puzo's The Godfather, Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone. It's available on video on demand. Monday on Fresh Air, our guest will be CNN's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. He's also a practicing neurosurgeon. He's written a new book about the brain that explains some of the latest research, debunks myths about brain function, and offers practical advice on improving your brain's function and resilience. We'll also talk about COVID, which he's been covering for CNN. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support by Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a happy and healthy New Year. We'll close with this New Year's song by Peggy Lee, who also wrote the lyric. I'm Terry Gross.
My dear acquaintance, it's so good to know you. For strength of your hand that's loving and giving, and a happy New Year with love overflowing, with joy in our hearts for the blessed New Year. Raise your glass and we'll have a cheer for us all who are gathered here, and a happy New Year to all that is living, to all that is gentle, kind and forgiving.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to helping businesses hire. When managers upgrade their job posts, they instantly get a list of candidates whose resumes on Indeed match their job criteria. More at indeed.com/credit. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.